Devices Radio Network.
Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome back to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson. I'm Scott McNally. Our programming is brought to you by TrueNutrition.com. You can use our code ADVICES. And now we're also brought to you by Azoth, one of the best nootropic products out of the market. We have links in the description below to both of these things. Dr. Scott Stevenson, what's up, man? How you been?
It's been 2 weeks.
It is.
A lot of shit that's gone down in the last 2 weeks.
God, tell me about it, man.
Yeah. I mean, that's been covered so much. Obviously, condolences to all of Luke's buddies, friends, family.
Yeah.
I've been calling people that I would have never thought they would have ever do and haven't. No one has, luckily, done anything to themselves horrific in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
During this social isolation, distancing thing we've got going on with the pandemic. But I've just been calling people like that. Just something like that I sensed maybe they could use a check-in, you know?
Yeah.
It's been nice. One person I did that not long after I heard that Luke had passed, and it was like perfect timing.
Yeah?
It's like, it's exactly what I needed right now.
Oh, that's cool, man.
Yeah, so I've been trying to practice that. I talked with someone last night I hadn't talked to for a while, so
yeah.
That's what I'm trying to take from all that. Obviously that, you know, seize the day, live in the moment.
Absolutely.
Everyone's precious. But
yeah, it really is. That's cool too. And I feel like, you know what, I've found in my life that when you know you're helping other people, you're also helping yourself. You know, that by getting out of my own head and doing something that helps somebody else, even if it's like, you know, taking your dog for a walk, that stuff is, I think, good. And when I say spirituality, I don't mean like religion, but I mean like my sense of peace in the world and everything, that by helping other people, it definitely helps me. There's no question.
It's, I mean, in the perspective of Viktor Frankl, who wrote A Man's Search for Meaning, he's the Holocaust survivor. I think I may have mentioned him before. Have I mentioned him on the podcast?
Maybe you and I should talk about it. It's ringing a bell. I know you have. I don't know if it was on the show or not, though.
Well, one of the things actually I did as well was I listened to / read a couple audiobooks that were one which is a lecture series follow up to his book A Man's Search for Meaning. It's one of the most seen it voted as one of the most important books of the 20th century.
Huh.
He was a Holocaust survivor. He was a psychiatrist who made it through the Holocaust. One of few that did, and he actually had a lot of these thoughts in a manuscript, which he lost during that time. Of course, he was hoping to hold on to, but it's just in a way.
Yeah.
And what came from his experiences there was this book and a couple other books and something called logotherapy, which is sort of it's based on the premise that man's primary drive or will, so to speak, is to find meaning in life. And so basically one way you can kind of boil it down is that the sort of the point of being a human being, the meaning of life comes in being the best human that you can be in every moment possible.
Yeah, I can see
to
that.
To the extent that's possible, yeah.
And
the rule of thumb, and I'm just paraphrasing it, but the rule of thumb that I find works really, really well, it's basically sort of connected to a mindfulness process, is to live every moment as if living it for the second time. Knowing mistake that you're about to make.
I remember you saying that before. Whether it was on the show or not, I'm not sure.
I share that often because I repeat it to myself all the time.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the thing. It's like, you know, you think about someone like, you know, I wonder, I know they're having a hard time because I know this, that, and this about them.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't want to think, you know, shoot, I should have called that person.
Yeah.
You know, that was the mistake that you might have made, you know, in the first version of this particular moment. So if you think of this as a chance to it's like a mulligan. Like,
yeah.
Think about going through your days as if you've got a series of mulligans, and what might I do now that wouldn't be the best choice if I were being as good as I possibly can be, or doing everything as right as I possibly can.
Yeah.
God, this came up in talking to my mom. There's a famous, I think it was at Dartmouth or Princeton, I think it, an Ivy League school. Or seminary students, and they gave them they had an interview with them, and the context of this is that they're on the campus and they're told that they need to go give a talk about being a good Samaritan and helping your neighbor and helping people in need across campus. And I think they brought them in, told them, we'd like you to do this. This is, of course, a topic that any of these seminary students can talk, you know, right off the top of their head on.
Right.
Because that's a very, you know, that's a very wonderful thing to do, religious or not. And they gave them, I think, three different conditions with various levels of urgency. And so in one, they said, okay, they're waiting for you right now. They've already gathered. Please get there as soon as you can. They're getting together now, so just whenever you're ready, head on over. Or something like, you know, just take your time. They'll be ready for you whenever you arrive.
Yeah.
Something like that. So, and then they planted along their route. There's always only one way to get over there. And maybe they watched them and made sure this happened. Someone who was like lying on the ground who'd been injured. And the context which makes this so crazy is that they're going to give a talk about helping people in need. And there's someone in need on their way over. When they were given this urgency, urgent message, like get over there as soon as you can. They're waiting on you. Very few of those seminary students did anything. Many of them didn't stop at all.
Yeah.
And when they were told, you know, take your time, you got plenty of time, there was a higher percentage, but it wasn't all of them even. Because they still were in their mind thinking, I have this thing I have to do. I have this responsibility.
Huh.
That was like this administrative responsibility. They're going to go deliver this message.
Yeah,
hoping
yeah.
that it would then, you know, propagate out in the minds of the people who listened so that they would then act in that way.
Right.
But at the same time, many of those, and these are seminary students who have devoted their lives to this notion of living this way and being, you know, the prime example of a public benefactor and caring for others, who literally weren't practicing what they were preaching, weren't practicing what they literally were thinking about as they were going across campus. So
I feel like that was a trick question. They tricked those kids. That's I get it.
That was the idea of the experiment, is to see can they be tricked? Like can life trick you into not living as the best person you know you should?
Yeah, yeah.
And it can. It totally can. We got all these things we think we have to do that we, you know, I got to like, you know, shit, I got to, like, I'm going to, I don't know, the hardware store to get something. And there's someone, you know, you got all this stuff. You got jumper cables. You know how cars work. You know, someone's broken down. And you're like, I got this thing I got to do. And like, blah, blah, blah. Thinking about, I got this list of things to do. And there's someone who's broken down on the side of the road. And literally, you're going to get things to put in your car for the next time you break down. You're going to get an emergency kit for your car.
Right.
There's someone who's in an emergency, you know?
Right.
So anyway, that's what, you know, when those are huge wake up calls. I think when people are lost like that, you know, there's, not that I'm in any way casting any blame on anyone.
Yeah, no, of course
not. Not the least bit. But you just, I think it gives you an opportunity to rethink, you know, the current moment. And say, what's really important? People's lives that I care about, those are the most important things. That people are happy, that they're cared for, that they're loved. Like, that's all we really want.
Sure.
You know, we try to – people work all this time so they can have money so that they know their kids will love them because they cared for their family. They know they've cared for their family so that you can have this feeling of love. It's really all about being loved, in my mind. Yeah. Not to get too woo-woo and wishy-wishy here about all this. But and so we often put all these other things in front, when really the whole point is the love. And you're missing the point if you don't take the love in or give the love out when you have the immediate opportunity to do so.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense, man. And it's a good kind of lesson to have looked at and been and made yourself almost reminded yourself of the importance of, you know, in the wake of some serious tragedy here.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, Viktor Frankl, Frankl. I highly recommend the book. You can get everywhere. It's a great book.
Right on.
So,
So today, Scott's going to teach us all about why we don't need to lift weights anymore.
Yes. Just stop it. Because there's more important loving things you can do. You should all go down, screw the gym, go to the soup kitchen, go help people on the road, on the side of the road who've fallen down.
No, I was looking at your chart. All I need to do is just sit here and flex my bicep, and it's gonna grow. I looked at the chart.
CT Flexusac commands you to grow?
Yes, looked at the chart. That's all. I think that's. Is that what you're telling me here?
Pretty much. Yeah. You don't even like, you don't, you can basically just call and cancel. Now that the gym's going to be open again for lots of people, you can just cancel the membership. You don't even need it.
So what is this? What are we talking about here today?
So last time we talked about a whole bunch of shit. I can't remember all the topics, but training at home and trying to make it work and finding a, you know, trying to optimize the training principles, the exercises that you choose and how many sets and reps you do, all the training program parameters. And the thing I posted yesterday on Instagram, I just had a very simple leg day, basically. But it was a good one. And the main thing that I've said from like the very beginning is like really a lot of it, those are all can be important. Obviously, you just can't train like do too much or train every single day and never rest and recover.
Yeah.
But in terms of creating the training stimulus, it's how hard you're willing to train, essentially. And you can look at that in terms of progressive overload too for people that aren't genetically gifted. If they're going to employ progressive overload, a logbook is so important for that.
Yeah.
Because it gives you a marker to keep moving forward. But that's only going to happen if you're adapting behind all of that. So progressive overload can be the thing that you force to happen using training markers in the gym. And that's the way people typically think about it. But the other sort of side of progressive overload is that you have created the stimulus that evoked the adaptation such that the overload manifests itself in your next workout. You simply are. If you could be an automaton and have this effort be exactly the same, if you have grown, if you have progressed, if the muscle's gotten bigger and it receives the same neurological input, all other things are kept the same, which really can't do, but hypothetically, then the overload should manifest because the muscle now is bigger. You got a larger engine, so you can drive it faster. So you get more reps or use a higher weight or both.
Yeah.
So, and the main thing about that then is effort. Eventually, you know, you have to be able to train as hard as you can. If the effort isn't there, there's going to be a plateau. You can think of it this way. Imagine if someone just limited themselves to always training at a 7 out of 10 on a RPE scale or exertion scale.
Okay.
Then they would their growth and their gains would plateau out at the 7 out of 10 level, whatever that may be for them, based on all the other things that they do. But what if they didn't decide, I'm going to up it to 8 now? They're going to start getting more reps. It's going to evoke more adaptation. They start progressing. So effort is something that builds over the course of years. And like Dorian Yates was an example. Someone had to taper his volume back down because he learned to train so hard.
Right.
Train too hard, you know, as he's admitted, I think, and that was caused some of his muscle tears there. He didn't know when to pull back. He was dancing with the one who brought him too long, you know, deep into the prep before the Olympia.
Yeah.
But so that's something I quoted from a paper that Stu Phillips was one of the last authors on. It's literally about program design and like what are the parameters, how, you know, what's the volume that we need to produce, the whole volume dose response idea, what frequency, you know, does rest interval matter? What about the number of reps per set? Does that make a difference?
Okay.
You know, of course, there's high load, low load. So you can train with very low loads and you can get growth. So the idea that used to be like, you got to train heavy to grow. Like, well, we know at least in beginners, that's not the case. And you ask anyone who's done a DC style Widowmaker for 23 reps, you know, where they had a chat with God in the last rep, you know, those will make you grow if you keep doing those,
yeah.
You know, and don't do too much. And then there's blood flow restriction. Something about that as to whether it's the restriction of the metabolic stress. It's hard to know. There's a paper actually that I just came across. Actually, rediscovered again, where they compared full range of motion training with doing partials, in the like half range of motion. And the partials actually, I think it was elbow flexors, showed greater muscle growth. And this is what I have people do as part of a pump set very often in fortitude training. You can do just regular full repetitions. That 20 to 30 rep range, we know that'll create growth if you're taking the sets to failure, which you do. But the partials don't allow blood flow to return to the muscle. So like if you, especially if you're using like, let's say you're doing a standing dumbbell curl and you're at the bottom and you go to full extension at the elbow, you can get blood flow through that will push away the metabolic stress or allow the metabolites to be removed. So the metabolic stress is diminished.
Okay.
And then this particular study, there was a correlation between the hypoxia, so the oxygen saturation of the hemoglobin, and the growth that was produced.
Hmm.
So there's something about doing even partials that which will work. So what that kind of points to is that training really, really hard or evoking a strong contraction, an effortful contraction, is a very important aspect of making muscle grow.
Hmm.
And like the quintessential example of this came out of Jeremy Lenicki's lab, and he's done a lot of the BFR stuff.
Okay.
This is a study that you're referring to, the one that I sent you the figure from by Counts et al. So let me pull it up here. Maybe you can get it up on the screen.
All right.
Folks. Let's
see. All right. I've got that up.
So is it published in 2017? The reference is right there in the middle of the thing. Oh, sorry, 2016. My bad. They have a review article in 2017. So in the panels, upper, the A and B, basically anterior means elbow flexors, biceps, measured muscle thickness. And the measurements were done before and after. There was 18 training sessions, 3 times a week over 6 weeks is all.
Okay.
And the atrophies indicate a significant difference. So you can see at these different measurement sites, this is just the percentage along the length of the muscle in the relaxed position. So basically measured just about in the middle of the muscle.
Okay.
The muscle thickness. And in the no load anterior condition, all the people did, all those subjects did, were 4 sets of 20 reps. They weren't holding a dumbbell. There was no band. There was nothing. They were just contracting through all 20 of those reps, 30 seconds rest in between.
Okay.
So, and they produced muscle growth. Just nothing. They had nothing.
Okay. They had
no bands, no bungee cords. No, they weren't using like, you know, tiddlywinks. They're holding nothing. All they're doing is doing a contraction as hard as they could for those 20 reps.
Yeah.
And so they did 80 reps, and there's 30 seconds between each set of 20 reps. When they compared that with a more traditional 4 reps, 8 to 12 with 70% of 1 rep max, minute and a half rest in between, you got the same relative muscle growth in that group.
Huh.
Groups.
Now, I got to ask, you know, are these trained people? Like, what's.
They're untrained.
So it's, sure. Does that translate in any way to us then? Because that's my first question that I guess comes up. Because I always feel like that's where the argument is like, well, what about, you know, highly trained individuals that are going to the gym on a regular basis? I mean, obviously they don't have that information here, but right. I know that you've thought about it.
Yeah. So here's the thing. Like that's kind of, that's the limitation of almost all of this, all of these studies. And the main reason, this is a topic we can delve into, is statistically speaking, you want to have a stimulus that provides an effect.
Okay.
So you want to find individuals who are going to have some muscle growth. So then you can compare the extent of muscle growth between two groups, a control group, or in this case, two conditions. They actually had a control condition who didn't do anything.
Okay.
They made some measurements there too, and nothing changed in those individuals. We'll talk about the bottom C and D panels on that figure here next. But
okay.
So yeah, absolutely. You're not going to expect the same extent of gains in a trained person. There's the law of diminishing returns that applies here.
Yeah.
And if you tried to use trained people, there's a bunch of issues that are there. One, you may have to train, if someone's been training for 5 or 10 years,
yeah,
you may have to do something for a year. You may have to employ a particular training strategy for a year to get something, given the precision of measurement that you're using, even if it's MRI or ultrasound, in order to see if there, to even manifest an effect,
yeah,
that you can pick up on statistically.
Okay.
So that's the difficult thing.
Yeah.
And probably even more so than that is trained people don't want to like, they don't want to give up what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be a lot. I couldn't imagine if you're like, hey, Scott, we're going to do this study, but I'm going to need you to train this particular way for a given year. Hey, it's going to benefit us in the long run as a community. I'd still be like, yeah, I don't know, Scott. I want to keep doing what I'm doing.
Yeah. So it's sort of like just a thought came into my head because I'm thinking about painting my, this is why it happened, thinking about painting my truck and doing some undercoating covering on the truck. It's like, let's say you want to look at the impact of sunlight on different types of paints, something like that.
Okay.
So, you know, and you want to know how's my paint going to do like 2 or 3 or 5 years from now.
Yeah.
There's actually a guy I found, he actually had like a 2-year follow-up where he painted this bar and he looked at the drill of oxidation with these different paints, like five or six. It's pretty cool because he's been on YouTube for a long time.
Huh.
So he actually got to see like, it wasn't on a car, so it didn't expose to salt or what have you, but it's kind of cool, like 2 years.
Huh.
So like unless you want to wait that long, you know, for something like that, you might do something then where you would come up with some way to accelerate the processes that you know happen with sunlight. So maybe you put it in an oven with, you know, UV rays, if that's the wavelength that is the most damaging to paint.
Yeah.
And, you know, up the ante. And then you just sort of say, well, we saw that this paint did better than that paint, and this paint did better than that paint. That wasn't exactly the same as real life environmental conditions, but it gives us some idea. So it tells us here that, and the bodybuilders know this too. This is the other thing that's interesting. It tells us that at least in these untrained people who are really sensitive to a change in muscle contractions and a change in exercise that would evoke hypertrophy, that you can create essentially in this case an equivalent hypertrophic stimulus, an equivalent adaptation from training with no loads in this way. They had done some pilot work to figure out that this is the best way to create this sort of growth. So that's why the reps are different and sets are different. But so it gives you some idea. It informs. It doesn't say that, you know, for sure you're not going to get a trained person and have them just, you know, give up the gym and just start doing like, you know, just wake up in the morning and just like look at your arm and do sets of 20. But it tells you that there's something going on there. And people do this when they start getting ready for shows. Posing actually can change. And this has been the perception of bodybuilders for decades, is that if you do a lot of posing, one, you learn better muscle control.
Sure.
It probably translates in terms of the mind-muscle connection, but it seems like it also can sort of make the physique better. So imagine someone, let's say, who's got a good posing room. So we're going to sort of translate this idea just to make it in a creative a way that maybe someone might understand it and believe that there's some value in this information. So in this posing room, you can see front, back, side. You got, you know, a mirror so you can see yourself when you're doing your rear poses, which you essentially never can in the gym.
Yeah.
You can never see your back.
No, you really
can't.
And
you got your shirt. No, you can't. So you got your shirt off. You can see, you know, when you pull back before a lat spread, where and when you get the best contractions on the lower lats to show the detail that you've been working towards for weeks in your diet and in your off season. So you learn how to do create a better mind muscle connection because you can actually see the muscle, you can feel the muscle, you know exactly what's going on. So that, and then you can then take that into the gym because you know how that feels now. You've practiced that and you can then start training that way and improve things. Plus, it may have been that without having that visual feedback, when you're doing. And there's Brad Schoenfeld has a study that's just come out not too long ago, looking at an internal versus an external attentional focus. And this is what I talk about in this mind-muscle connection. Mind-muscle mastery is the name, I think, of the presentation. And it didn't happen in the quads. They had people do knee extensions and just elbow flexion training. But when they just focused on squeezing the muscle, literally they told them, squeeze the muscle. Or keep that weight moving, or move the weight, lift it up in the elbow flexors, the biceps, which I think most people probably have a better natural mind-muscle connection with anyway. It's a smaller muscle, easier to focus on. You can see it. It's right there in front of your face. they got better muscle growth with the internal focus over the course of this training program.
I can see that.
So training like this, especially, and that was, they found that effect in the biceps. This was the training, basically the biceps, the elbow flexors.
Okay.
Allows you to focus on the muscle. You're seeing it, you're feeling it. It's right there in your mind's eye, like literally, it's right there in front of your face.
Yeah.
In a way that people can't typically do. So posing is the same sort of thing. You're actually seeing, when I arch my back a little bit and I drive my scapula down and pull my elbows back, then I get a really good contraction. Oh, my back looks badass when I do that.
Yeah.
You can see sometimes, you ever seen people, and I see this all the time, you know, they're in shape. They've got a good back because they've been doing exercises that really develop their back well. And when they turn around to do that back pose, you know, you show the Christmas tree, mm-hmm. where you go to a lat spread, you're like, they just contract the upper part.
Mm-hmm.
They never get the lower, like you're waiting for that. They've got some really nice feathering, mm-hmm. and definition down where the lats connect.
But they don't know how to show it.
But they don't know how to show it.
Yeah.
And luckily, so those people actually have good development there. There are people mm-hmm. that, sometimes too, you can see this is they try to do that and they don't have much there, and you can see it in how they pose.
Yeah,
because they just don't know how to activate that. So this explains why why many people have found that posing helps them train more effectively.
Yeah,
and how even posing can help them develop their physique more effectively.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, so it's not four sets of 20 reps. So imagine the impact on your back. Let's just not make this biceps. Let's make this back.
Yeah.
Imagine you did 20 maximal effort contractions.
Okay.
Pulling your back like that.
Yeah.
For four sets of 20 with 30 reps, your back would be torched.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would be really freaking hard.
Yeah, that would.
I could see why that would make you sore.
And that
tells you, even though, like, I mean, they were actually literally doing concentric and eccentric contractions.
Hmm.
Let me pull up the EMG data here, because they actually measured EMG during a training session in the biceps, basically biceps and triceps, elbow flexors and extensors. And they had some co-contraction in the triceps.
Hey, what's up, guys? Scott here, and I want to take a really brief pause from this episode to shout out our new great sponsor, Azoth. Now, first of all, guys, I want to say that I only bring in companies that I truly, truly do believe in. You know, I believe in TrueNutrition.com, and I believe in GetAzoth.com. This is a total nootropic product. They've sponsored BNR, Bodybuilding Nerds Radio, for a number of years now. I'm super familiar with it. I've watched the company grow, and I've watched Prady do great things with it. And listen, here's my story. You know, in all honesty, I feel like I fucked up in the early part of my life, and I didn't get the things done that I should have done earlier on. And I'm trying to make up for that now, honestly. You know, I'm trying to be the best person I can and help people and, you know, try to put a retirement together for myself. I'm totally self-employed between podcasting full-time and nutrition coaching. My life is pretty demanding, and that's the way that I want to live it. I want to get the most I can out of life, and I want to have fun doing it. And if you can't tell, guys, I am having a lot of fun with this. By the way, I'm grateful for you guys listening and watching all the shows. Anyway, getazoth.com. I feel that my attention and my focus is increased when I use this. At the same time, I don't get the anxiety that goes along with a lot of stimulants. If you haven't tried a nootropic, this is the place that I would suggest going. Start out with these guys and let me know what you think. I've got links in the show descriptions. And if you haven't tried it, Prady even has an option to get a bottle for free. So it'll be no cost to you. You can see what it's all about. Either way, guys, check out getazoth.com and let me know what you think. Hey guys, why are you using sports nutrition that was designed for someone else? At TrueNutrition.com, they offer the world's largest selection of quality protein powders, and they let you design your own custom blend from a variety of powders, flavors, boosts, and packaging options, like the Team Skip blend, for instance. That's over 20 billion possible combinations to create a protein powder tailored to your diet, your goals, your tastes, and your budget.
TrueNutrition.com also offers the ability to create delicious custom oatmeal blends. And they're third-party tested, proving that all their supplements are ensured to have the highest level of quality and value. Don't be a sucker and pay for fancy packaging and gimmicks. Discover the source that bodybuilders trust and stop using mass-produced nutrition that wasn't designed for you. TrueNutrition.com. And use our code ADVICES at checkout to let them know that you support the shows.
So over the course of the sets, they've got an EMG EMG amplitude during the first three and the last three reps in the no load and the high load. No load and the high load, so nothing versus 70%. And literally we're talking in mid, like 50% of an MVC EMG in the no load, and it's like 65-70% in the loaded condition.
What does the EMG mean?
Oh, electromyography.
Okay.
So it's a measure of the electrical activity in the muscle.
So what is, like, say 50% of the...
When they did a maximal voluntary contraction, so they said, okay, pull as hard as you can, and they measured probably the integrated EMG, so they measured the electrical activity.
Yeah.
That represents maximal neurological drive, okay, maximal electrical activity during an all-out effort in that muscle.
Okay.
And then you can, so you take that value, and that would be sort of your denominator, and they measure the EMG during these no-load contractions or when actually lifting, and this is just a percentage of the max effort.
Yeah.
So it's an indirect indicator of maximal neurological input,
yeah,
to the muscle. So it's pretty close.
So did you say that is it 50? Did you say 50%
without 65 or 70?
And that's without any weight, and then,
yeah,
70 with like 70% of your max effort or max load.
Yeah, at the beginning of the set, it was about 55 versus 65 or 70.
And that's without any weight at all.
Yeah, so you're getting two-thirds, three-quarters. And here's the thing, too.
Yeah.
There can be movement artifact. There's different things. Like, there's EMG is not perfect. So some of that EMG can just be because of the nature of the electrical activity, because you're actually moving a weight.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll get like a higher EMG when you have someone hold a free weight versus just press with as much force against the solid object.
So just holding it itself is increasing the percentage.
It will. Yeah. I've seen data that suggests that.
Okay.
So, but they're pretty close. But the interesting thing is that the triceps were activated, as you would expect, during the no load condition.
Okay.
So kind of had to some degree, because, you know, if you're trying to do a controlled contraction with my arm, if you're trying to do a controlled contraction, you've got to have some activity back here. Otherwise, your arm would just completely flex.
Yeah.
So that's the interesting thing, and it's on the bottom of that figure. They had no explanation for this. They just said, we have to look into this. In the C and D, it shows the no load and the high load.
Okay.
And before and after. And no difference in tricep size in the no-load condition where they weren't training with weights. But they actually lost size in the triceps, at least two out of the three measurement sites.
Okay.
So they didn't have an explanation for that. Then they had a control group that did nothing. They didn't see this, so it wasn't as if there was some sort of systematic difference. So they also, when you do these, if you do these things properly, you've got a single person who is blinded to all the conditions, and they're just making the measurements.
Okay.
So they don't know who is who.
Huh.
Yeah. So let me see here. Let me check one thing. So they really had no idea. My guess is that there may have been, for some reason, kind of an altered activity pattern when just from the training. So they're doing all that biceps training. Maybe they stopped using their arms as much.
Okay.
Because, like, if your arm's sore, or maybe, you know how if you're sore all the time, like, imagine your legs are really sore.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't squat down very often. You end up bending at your back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could have been something. They're training three times a week. Maybe they're a little bit sore, so they stopped using their arms, just generally speaking. But because they had co-contraction in the triceps, when they were in the no-load condition, they actually had a mild training effect going on there.
Huh.
So that offset the disuse atrophy that would have happened. Or they don't know if it was disuse or not. They didn't measure that. But
wow, so. That's so weird. And, you know, I'll tell you overall, man, just like this whole topic, it makes me think with the whole shutdown and all the gym closures, which, you know, as you mentioned, it sounds like some of the gyms are starting to open back up. That's awesome. Michigan, not for a while, still a little while, I think we have.
Yeah.
But I can tell you, you know, working with clients around the country, this has been an interesting experiment to see what actually happens when you can't lift weights anymore. Because I've had a lot of people that they have, you know, people who live in apartments, they had no equipment. They bought a set of the Mountain Dog bands, you know, and that's like all they've been able to do for the last couple months. It's been interesting to see how much muscle a lot of people have retained. Like, I haven't seen anybody that I work with that's like, oh God, they've really shrunk up over this. And we're talking like, we've cut the food back a little bit because, you know, we don't want them to get fat. They're doing a lot less activity through the day. A, B, maybe they were using some super supplements and we say like, well, let's get off of that for now. So like we have reasons that people would shrink, but I'm not seeing like dramatic loss of muscle. Like I think that my bro mind would tell me, like, okay, you can't go to the gym anymore. I'm just going to shrink into nothing. And it's
just going to shrivel up. Right?
Yeah, it's not happening. So, I mean, a lot of these people are doing something similar to what you're talking about, at least. I mean, they're not just flexing against themselves, but I mean, some of these band workouts, I mean, some bands could be really good. And but some of them, man, some of the stuff I've seen, it's like, I think some people are doing some exercises that are pretty much just contracting the muscle as hard as they can to get the most out of it, you know?
Yeah, like that's, I mean, that's the mind most, that's, there was a, there's an old video you can find when Milos Sarcev was still training. I think it's a segment from the Battle for the Olympia. I know at least there's one segment in there, and he's training, I think he's in like it's a small gym, he's all by himself in there,
okay.
And he's just talking about this. He talks about, he's like training the weight and training the muscle. He's like really kind of going in. He's using really light weights,
yeah,
really slow contractions, but it's this really effortful, deep, internally, attentionally focused type of contractions that he's performing there.
Huh.
And that's what the mind muscle connection is about. You're trying to make the muscle contract. So I think it's just you make literally train to make the muscle make the weight feel as heavy as you possibly can.
Hmm.
So you can do that. I mean, here's one thing people have to watch out for instance, when they go back to the weight room is now they've developed a really nice mind-muscle connection.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say you're lifting 100 pounds. Well, you can actually get a training stimulus with just doing that motion with no weight.
Yeah.
And then you start lifting 100 pounds. And so you can basically have the force that's lifting the 100 pounds plus an extra amount of contraction on top of that.
Absolutely.
isn't going towards moving the weight. And then you can fool yourself into thinking there's a progressive overload happening in terms of strength if you just slowly start changing your focus from that's internal to more attentional.
Yeah, yeah.
You won't even see like you're cheating the weight, you're throwing the weight around, anything like that. You're just changing sort of your attentional focus on whether you're trying to get train the muscle or trying to move the weight through space.
Yeah.
And so you'll start using heavier weights because you have literally, there's a reserve of muscular contraction force that's available to you that you're not applying to moving the weight. It's that same muscular contraction force that was used in this particular study where they had no external load and they produced 55-60% of a maximal voluntary contraction EMG signal. So that's the thing that this like adds another layer that I'm actually just, this is just a kind of occurring to me now, is that you can have someone, you know, who's training with weights that are not the heaviest weights they could possibly lift, and moving those through space for X number of reps with really good form and they're getting a great stimulus because one, they're moving the weight. So the weight becomes sort of a tool to create the feedback and the proprioceptive information that allows for them to train the muscle. So, you know, obviously, you know, what you can feel which muscle is working because the muscle has to work to move the weight, But then their brain is using that information to up the ante, to increase the contraction and produce a stronger contraction in exactly the way they did in this Counts et al. Study.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can produce a contraction that will produce muscle growth with no load. And that can be part of the contraction that you're using with any load up until you're basically to your max load.
Right, right.
So you can start off week by week and start going from 100 to 110, 120 pounds. That could have nothing to do with the muscle getting bigger. It's just because you're changing the way in which you're producing the contraction in the gym. So you got to be honest with yourself.
And that's the tough part. I you know, this is a conversation I remember we had had in the past. Talking about like the squeeze. Remember, and you remember, Scott, it was a few years ago now that like squeezing the weight, you know, was
Jordan used to make fun of that. Sometime.
He did.
Yeah.
He did.
Yeah.
And so there was kind of like some discussion.
Anymore.
Yeah. There was some discussion back then about, because, you know, back then he had said like it was just about, you know, moving the weight. And now he is, you know, moving as much weight as you possibly can and then progressing. And now he is, you know, he has talked about squeezing the weight and moving as much as you can. How do you figure that balance out? I guess, I mean, I can tell you that in my experience, I remember before working out with Shelby Starnes that I was dumbbell rowing basically whatever the gym had, you know, whatever dumbbell they had.
You're really strong on that measurement, on that movement.
Yeah. And I mean, but I wasn't squeezing as hard as I could. Then I started training with Shelby and he was like, we're going to do this different. I want you to contract, get the most you can out of this weight. And I went down to like the 85s, the 80s, mm-hmm. and it literally took me over a year, 2 years to build back up to like 120, 140 pounds. Mm-hmm. It took me a long time to be able to, like, it knocked me way down, but I got more out of it, I think. You know, I got more out of it, and it took me a long time to build that back up. But how do we determine, like, I don't know. How do we break that down, Scott? I don't even know what the question exactly is. Do you follow where I'm coming from, though?
Yeah, I think I do, because that's not something you can quantify.
You
can say, well, you know, 2/3 of my contraction went to lifting and 1/3 was, you know, creating a mind muscle connection, internally focused type of contraction.
Right, right.
You know, and that will change over time. So what that, and this was a principle that Dante used to talk about years ago.
Okay.
That I have people do, especially if they send me videos of them training or what have you, is you just basically say, okay, we're going to just cut your weights to 3/4 or 2/3 or half.
Okay.
Just cut them way down. I want you to make this as hard as you possibly can.
Yeah.
And just literally just start over again.
Yeah.
You know, as if you've not even, so like the one that works, this works really well is on like a squat.
Mm.
So I mean, I like to squat to where I'm a little bit past 90, but not quite to parallel. That feels kind of good for me.
Okay.
Just because of the way, like, I'm put together biomechanically. I've tried, but I can go all the way down. I have to drop the weight down quite a bit. It's almost like an entirely different movement.
Mm.
But I will do that sometimes. I'll drop all the way down and then just start over. and move myself back up. So for lots of people, they just, the depth starts creeping up on the squat.
Mm-hmm.
They're not, and they really would do best squatting like Tom Platz did, in Olympic style, Holy style, high bar squat. And for them, you just say, okay, you know, I can, you're off now. You're just trying to move the weight, cut the weight down. You know, you're at 400 pounds. Let's go back down to 315.
Okay.
Start over again.
Yeah.
Literally. So you take the ego completely out. Think of it as a brand new exercise, perfect form. You can even institute a pause at the bottom.
Mm. Yeah.
Of those, for instance, like the squeeze part, that's what the squeeze actually does to a certain degree. So if you're in a biceps, when you do that squeeze, you're literally not, it's not like that extra force is needed to hold the weight in that position.
Right.
That is superimposing upon the contraction that's necessary to hold the weight, this internally focused contraction, which was all that was at play in this particular study.
Mm-hmm.
So it's adding on top of that. So when you do the squeeze, you ensure that you've got that internally focused aspect of the muscle contraction in play.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you're turning that on and you're making sure it's there and that it's playing a role as you're moving the weight each and every time. So that's why that actually makes sense to do that. is that if you can at least be somewhat honest and make your squeeze, so to speak, which is a way to sort of ensure that you're flipping the switch on the internally attentionally focused aspect of the contraction each and every rep, then you've got a maximal contribution of that internally focused contraction. And you do that every rep. The squeeze happens every single time. That's there to the extent which you can possibly do it. And then you're going to fatigue, of course, eventually, because the muscle fatigues, and the set will eventually come to an end because you no longer do another rep.
Yeah.
So, let's say you do a set like this, just for the sake of comparison.
Okay.
And you lift the first one and you do a squeeze, and you go back down again and do a squeeze and go back down again. You're doing like a little whole little squeeze each time. And then you get to like, you're coming near the end of your set, and instead of doing the squeeze, you just start doing this. You just start moving the weight again.
Yeah.
And then you've changed the nature of each of those reps.
Yeah.
And you can do that. Like that's akin to what you would do with a mechanical drop set. That's akin to changing your foot placement, for instance, during the course of a leg press, something like that, to take the focus to start engaging other muscles rather than your quads. Let's say you started with your feet low and together on a leg press, and you want to extend the set. And when the quads start to fatigue and the reps would be over with, you spread your feet out wider, and now you can use a little more hamstrings and posterior chain.
Right.
But your quads are still the weak link.
Right.
You know, and you keep doing that, and eventually you come to the end of the set when you basically can't move the weight no matter what you do with your feet.
Right.
So mechanical drop sets do that.
I like
different
that.
Changes in foot position or hand position, and then this aspect of the squeeze. So you could start off if you're not like really. This would be for a set that's not going to be like one where you try to be strict with the progressive overload. But you could start a set off with lots of squeeze, ensuring that you're getting a good mind muscle connection. That just sets you up to do the exercise, quote unquote, right.
Yeah.
With the tensional focus, and then when the squeeze is no longer something that you can do, or when you're starting to feel like the set's coming to an end, you can maybe bang out more reps.
Yeah.
Because now you take whatever contractile energy, and literally this is, we're talking about energy demand, and redistribute that energy supply to just moving the weight.
Yeah.
And so you get the last three or four reps or without the squeeze.
Yeah.
And by that time, if you've done a good job, you don't have any accessory muscles that are fatigued. Oh, like your weak link is the biceps.
Yeah.
And just trying to get, and so that's what, that's one thing that people can do with like a pump set, fortitude training, is you just start off, you start feeling the weight, you feel where it is, and like, those are some good partials I can do.
Yeah.
Just like the study I mentioned where the partial range of motion was better for the biceps than a full range of motion. And that had to do with the hypoxia that was elicited. So you could do a pump set where you're doing a squeeze at the top of every rep,
yeah,
and then extend the set by stopping the squeezing and just going into just basically regular full reps, and then extend the set by doing partial reps where you can still hold the weight.
And you know what, too? You can do all that without really losing form, you know? I mean, it's like if you start out without that intentional contraction in the muscle – then when you fail there, you don't have as much room to, like, you could go to partials, but you don't have that, like, that card to play versus I know exactly what you mean. If you're being like really honest and strict with your contractions and your muscle on each rep, then once you can't do that anymore, you could still keep really good form and still move the weight and still keep it in that intended muscle. There's no question about it. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm just getting fired up here. I'm thinking about lifting weights now, you know?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, like when you do those squeezes, and you're really employing a really good mind muscle connection in the muscle you're trying to train. That also means, like, let's say it's on a leg press. Go back to the leg press. Let's say you're doing your squeeze literally when your knees are extended. You don't want to hyperextend, of course. That's not going to be a good thing for your knees. But you're doing that on your quads.
Yeah.
At the end. And people will do, or like even a chest press may be a better example. And you're trying to pull your hands together on the bar, even though they won't go. And you do that each and every time. That ensures that muscle is getting fatigued more so than the other muscles, the accessory muscles that help you move the load.
Okay.
So if you're a delt pusher, so to speak, and you tend to activate your delts more so than your pecs on pressing movements, if you do employ that squeeze, you're basically in that set, basically using a sort of a pre-fatiguing technique.
Yeah, you are, really.
To make sure that the pec is the muscle that gets targeted. So when you do start just pumping out the reps without the squeeze, your pec is going to be the muscle that fails, which is the whole point of doing the exercise.
I've done this with lat pull downs because and we've talked about how my lats, I back width has been something that hadn't been as dense for me as like my back thickness, that a lot of my back development would go to like the rhomboids, and I just had trained myself. And that's one of the reasons, like when I was like mentioning being strong on my dumbbell rows, another aspect of that is I was using like a lot of central mid back on my dumbbell rows.
Twisting.
Well, it's just in the way I rode. It's just like keeping my elbow in really tight. I can still feel it just doing this. Like I can feel those rhomboids just popping out when I go like that. But, you know what, doing something like a lat pull down though, I've unconsciously experimented with this, getting those really good contractions, really squeezing. And then when I can't do them, say I'll do eight and then get eight more without that squeeze. And I still feel it deeply in like all down through the armpit, down the side, you know, exactly where I'd want to contract. So I like that. Whatever I do, I'm training back next. I'm going to employ this in at least two of my exercises. I'm going to see what I can do with this now.
Yeah. I mean, imagine like, and I've done this with people on like you have a hard time getting a muscle to activate is first do a pre-fatiguing isolation type of movement.
Yeah.
So the pullover, something like that. And then you say, what I want you to do, you give them all the cues.
Yeah.
Hands as hooks, elbows as hinges. Use a false grip that keeps them from squeezing and using their arms. And now the first thing I want you to do is engage with your back muscles. So allow your scapula to rotate down and your elbows to drive, like you're trying to put your elbows in your pockets.
Yeah.
So initiate with the muscle that you're trying to target. And then do a squeeze at the bottom and literally have them just hold that there. Like maybe it's funny with back too, I see this so often is – they're like, it's almost like they've become partially deaf or something during the set. You're like, okay, what I want you to do is pull the weight down and just hold it there. And they'll go like this and they'll go back up. No, nope, hold it there. No, stop, bring it down, hold it. And they just keep on going.
Yeah.
And some of that is because I think maybe even subconsciously, they don't even know what to do. It's like they don't even know what it means to like hold the weight at the bottom using their back. Like they can't even carry that out.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I want you to close your fist, and they're like, it's like they've never closed their fist before. It's like, I don't even know how to do this. Like,
yeah,
what does that mean to close my fist?
Yeah.
Like, what does that mean to hold with my back muscles?
Mm-hmm.
So then you use like touch training and say, do you feel it down here? Like poke them in their back.
Yeah.
I think Charles Glass does that a lot, if I recall. Maybe
a little bit of
touch training.
I feel like I've seen him do that, yeah.
Yeah, it'll give you a little feedback. There's some information that suggests that's the case. But literally, and just have them, like that's what partials do on pump sets, is like literally you're doing those partials where you feel the muscle the best. Whatever it happens to be on that particular day for that particular exercise.
Yeah.
And for some exercises, depending on whether it maybe got a cam on there, whether that cam creates a loading curve in the exercise that matches your strength curve will determine where that best point is for doing those partials or making that mind muscle. So you don't necessarily have to do the squeeze, so to speak, at one end of the range of motion.
Yeah.
It could be where you feel it best.
Yeah. It makes sense.
Yeah. So it could be anywhere.
Yeah.
There's so much. So like you put all those things together and you can just metamorphosize someone's ability to have a good connection with the muscle that they hadn't before.
Yeah. I found hamstrings were a big one for me I had done in the past that I really focused on squeezing, and that helped me to get a lot more out of the muscle, just because without that, it was just kind of like, I don't know what I was doing, but I just
fish out of water, just flopping around.
Yeah. It was just like moving the weight. You know what I mean? And
yeah,
the hamstrings would kind of, they'd get sore, but they weren't developing and I didn't know why, but yeah, being able to like really hold and squeeze, control those negatives, all that stuff, man, made a big difference for me.
You have the gastroc as a biarticulate muscle. It crosses the knee, it flexes the knee like the hamstrings. Your gastroc's so fucking big.
They probably took over.
Oh, of course, yeah. Like your system knows that. It's like, so where are my mechanical advantages going to be? What muscle, if I want to move this weight through space and time?
Yeah.
you know, do my reps of my set. Like, I'm going to use the muscle that I have available. It's like if I need to move that log, you know, from across town, I don't try to put it on top of my Subaru,
right?
You know, on my bike, I put it in the back of my truck.
Right, right.
You know, so you got your calves, your gas truck was just
the best easily, tool.
Yeah, of course. Right. Yeah.
You know where I see that big time is when I try to do dumbbell hamstring curls.
Oh,
you know, yes. That's like a right. huge calf workout for me. There's no question.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So do you usually pull your feet up, dorsiflex, pull your toes up when you do your hamstring work?
What I try to do is I just let my try to disengage my feet, actually.
Okay.
I try to just like let them hang.
Point them. Yeah, point them.
Yeah, I just try to like let them hang. I try to focus on not flexing my feet in any direction. It's right. like my feet are just like dead weight on the end of my legs, yeah. you know, that are moving right. up and down. That I found works. And then there's just been a lot of stuff. Like, and I got to bring back Shelby up again because it's like he was the first person to really help me with that. Like the seated hamstring curl, we would do things like bring the weight down and then hold it for 3 full seconds. And I use this phrase to people that I work with too. Now I say like, squeeze your hamstrings as hard as you can. Like imagine you're trying to make them spasm. Like squeeze right. them as hard as you fucking can. And you know what too? This is something you brought up a little bit earlier, Scott. The more often you do that, the harder you can squeeze them. Like the first week you try that, you can squeeze them, you know, and it's like, wow, that really hurt. But the third week and the fourth week and the fifth week, man, it just keeps getting stronger and stronger.
Skill.
It really does.
Yeah.
And I think that that's where, for me, my hamstring development really came into play was being able to squeeze them so hard. And it's changed the way my legs fire, you know?
Yeah. I was going to say, yeah, I mix that up. Plantar flexing will disengage the gastroc. For you, like, probably any time, like, your body's just going to use your gastroc whenever it possibly can. Like, you know,
sure.
if you could use your gastrocs to do overhead presses, you would, because you'll bounce up and down on your toes like you do.
I showed you that on
laterals.
Yeah, exactly. On the laterals. Right? Yeah.
It's like how this guy's using his calves to do straight shoulders. What the fuck? No wonder they're gigantic. But, yeah, I've had people do that. It's a really nice technique. Actually, it's sort of a leverage tile drop set. It's like on a, works great on seated hamstring curl is you start off with your toes plantar flexed.
Okay.
And what that does, it puts slack on the gastroc. So really your nervous system figures this out. There's no ability because the muscle is not at a length where it can produce much force.
And that's like stretched out. So your foot's.
No, the other way, plantar flex. So point your toes.
Pointed toes.
Okay. Yeah. So point your toes while you're doing the hamstring curl. And so take your set to failure or like one or two reps shy of failure that way. And then to extend the set, you can then use your gastroc as to basically do forced reps, dorsiflex, pull your toes up, and now your gastroc can be engaged, but it's fresh.
Yeah.
It still won't be a weak link because your hamstrings, they tend to fatigue pretty easily. Hamstrings are a pretty fatigable muscle. So once you do that, you can bang out another 5 or 6 reps.
Okay, yeah.
In most cases, depending on what your weight you've chosen, how heavy it was.
That'd be a fun one to try, too. That'd be a fun one.
Oh, they're brutal. Yeah,
hey,
if
anybody tries that, try that. You know, let me know. Let us know. Leave us a comment here, you know, either on the YouTube or on the post on Facebook or wherever. I'd be curious to hear people's experience on that because it sounds like you could – if you haven't paid attention to that before, it could be a game changer in your hamstring training.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to do like a rest pause set, like a DC style rest pause set, you basically can get 2 failure points in the course of every set.
Okay.
So do that. Do like literally go until you're about to fail, and then go from pointed to toes pulled back. You'll get 3 or 4 more reps.
Yeah.
Do the same thing the next. Start off pointed, pull toes back, and you'll get 2 failure points for the price of 1.
Okay.
Doing that. You can do the same thing essentially on a preacher curl machine. If you have a machine where you can just put the bar on your hands without squeezing.
Yeah.
Because your forearms are also elbow flexors.
Okay.
The wrist flexors they cross the elbow. So they're weak, very weak, but they do contribute. So if you're here, your hands are straight and as long as you can't do this with the free weight because it'll just roll out of your hand.
Yeah.
But on a machine, you know, that keeps you in an arc, you can just put the weight there kind of across the palm of your hand
sure.
and go to failure. and then squeeze, and then you'll be able to engage the wrist flexors, which are also elbow flexors.
I've seen that. Yeah.
Large extent, yeah. And you'll get two or three more reps that way too.
Yeah. I used to years ago when I do curls, squeeze the bar as hard as I could. Now I have to be careful with that. That's how I end up with tennis elbow and stuff like that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Sometimes that will work for some people, the squeezing thing.
Yeah.
Like if you squeeze like on a barbell press, you know, uh-huh. and you're trying to put your hands this way, that can kind of help with,
yeah.
with sort of, you're trying to do a fly, but you can't.
Yeah. I can
so
see
it
that.
It changes the nature of the contraction, but, I'd love to see what people have to say, if they try that palms open to then gripping.
Yeah. That'd be cool.
The course of the set. Yeah.
That'd be cool.
The same thing.
Anything else you want to cover on this topic? Because we had a couple other things. We had, I think we had a question that's popped up too.
Oh, we did? Okay. Yeah, we can do the question. No, I think that's plenty. We could go on. I guess there is one thing. So this is an opportunity for everyone. When we go back to the gym now, you're going to probably have lost some strength. So this is an opportunity now with all the equipment for everyone who's going back whenever they eventually get back. To reset their form, don't try to go right back to your regular weight. You're probably gonna get pretty sore. Just like you may have gotten sore if you started doing bands because it's something new and different.
Yeah.
If you haven't been training at all, then you know obviously like one set, three or four reps shy of failure is probably plenty.
Yeah.
Just elicit that protective effect and can go back to it. But this is an opportunity now because I think a lot of people have figured out through all this home training with the bands and what have you how to make the most. From exercises that weren't necessarily of optimal engineering design, biomechanical design. So you're figuring out how to use the bands and get a really good contraction.
Yeah.
You can use no bands and get a really good contraction, which is what this study showed. So take that, and then now you can make what you get out of the gym, where you may have some really good machines or your choice of your best exercises, you can make them even better. So don't unlearn what you learned during the course of the pandemic training.
Right.
Keep those ideas in mind, and don't worry about like just jumping up to the weights you once used.
Yeah.
Because a lot of that's going to happen in many cases if you try to go too fast, not because you've grown in any way, shape, or form. We're thinking about bodybuilders here, but just because you probably aren't having maybe the good mind-muscle connection that you would like to.
Mm, yeah.
So give it time. It'll come. It won't take that long. You know, usually half the time it took to lose it is what it might take to get it back, something like that.
Okay. Yeah, I found my strength has, you know, it took a dip. You know, I had been pushing the 110-pound dumbbells. You know, Scott, I never went heavier than 115. Mm-hmm. That I just kept trying to get better at using that weight.
I remember that, yeah.
And that's as high as I went. I did hit the 115s at one point. Toward the end, right before everything shut down. But I have gotten to train where there's some decent equipment. And I found that I could still push like the hundreds really, really well controlled. And instead of going back up to the 110s, I've just stayed with the hundreds. And I'm just trying to just get more out of it until I feel like I own those weights. And once I can do that, then I'm going to climb back up. But I mean, really, man, that's not far off, you know, weight wise. So
no, and you don't, because it's new and novel again. You're going to get a good stimulus. You're like, people have been using this idea of like you're resensitized or having sort of creating a resensitization effect, so that you can get more from a given number of sets and reps.
Yeah,
and you're going to, and there's a greater skill component with free weights than there are with machines.
Mm, yeah.
Because so you're going to lose more on free weights than you were with machines. You may have lost some, but may have lost nothing.
Yeah.
I bet some people come back and are maybe even stronger on certain things.
Yeah, I could see that.
Be surprised. Like things that that require balance that they may have had to sort of employ because they're using bands and like they're used to wobbling all around, you know, that sort of thing.
Pec deck. I've used more on pec deck than I had in the past.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know if it's because everything I've been doing at home was free weight related, but I didn't pay attention when I was putting the pins in the first workout back. And I was like three plates higher than I had been using in the past. I was like, wow. Because it was really hard. And then I hadn't really been paying attention. I just did a feeder and then popped a couple more pins in, you know, listen to my music for a second, do another feeder, pop the pins in, you know, get focused. And then I was like, okay, that feels heavy. Did a working set. And then I looked at it and I was like, wow.
Yeah.
I went like 30 pounds heavier than I had been in the past.
And that's the thing, you know, we're so conscious of what the weight is. You know exactly what you can't help. You know it's on the bar because you've been doing this for years. So it's, you know, the math is almost automatic. It might as well just be like a big LED for you what it is. But don't worry about the weight. You know, get the most out of it you can, you know.
Yeah.
In the long haul, that's the best for your joints anyway, probably.
Yeah.
The
lighter
the weight you can use to get the muscle growth, the better. So what's this question we have? I haven't looked at it yet.
Let's see. I'm scrolling up here. We got a comment from Jeremy Jason. He says, "What's up, fellas? My one-car garage has transformed into Fortitude Central. Quarantine gains, baby."
I like it.
Yeah. Let's see.
He's got to post a picture then.
Where was that at? Okay. How about this? This is from Joseph. He says, "How would Scott set up push pull legs for off season bodybuilder?" It says OFC enhanced. Would he go 6 days per week or something else? I don't know what he means by, I don't know what OFC is short for.
Of course. I'm sorry.
Of course. That's what I was thinking too. Of course. Yeah. Enhanced.
I'm looking for the question here. I wasn't listening as well because I thought I could find it.
Which question is that?
Oh, here it is. The one you just read. I just couldn't find it for some reason. Set up a push-pull legs for off-season bodybuilder. Of course, we need 6 days per week. So there is a relationship between volume and frequency. Ronnie Coleman did
lightweight
push-pull legs.
Baby.
Lightweight baby. He picked up peanuts 6 days a week with a push-pull legs routine and a high volume, and basically no one else in the world could have gotten away with that, and I don't even know if Ronnie did.
Yeah.
You know, he pays the piper now for what he did. A lot of people do. It all depends on the person, what's looked for them. You always have to look back at what has been effective for those individuals. Mm. We talked about this before with the DAMA study, where some people did better, the group generally speaking, some people did better with higher frequency and higher volume. Some people do better with lower frequency, lower volume. So I would look at clues from the past to predict the future success.
Hmm.
So what? Why are they going to do a three-way split? Is that one that's worked before? Is this one that just seems like it makes sense because the workouts dwindle when they're doing a two-way split? So they need to, you know, break things up. Like that's one of the things. The best three-way split I know of, like right off the top of my head, is DC training three-way split. So, and that's a push-pull legs. You can do that. So that's what I would tell people to do, like with no other information.
Hmm.
But the volume is what's going to matter.
Yeah.
As in the frequency and how that best works for the person.
Huh.
Also, why are there any extra or muscle groups that need to be brought up? Is the person advanced? What did he say? Did he say how advanced he is?
No, he just, that's all he had to say.
Yeah, like there's just too many possibilities, but I would probably train no more than five times a week, probably maybe four.
Yeah.
And put the off days before and or after legs or pull, depending on where the person needs to bring those up.
Mm.
So you may need at least a day off before pulling. If you're going to go legs, pull, push, then definitely a day off between the legs and the pull.
Yeah.
Because the low back's going to get taxed.
Absolutely.
So there's just so many.
You know what, I'll add something in. You know, because I had a lot of questions, and I don't think I addressed all of them. After we did the episode about having brought up my back.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I had gone from a one body part, a day, 5 day a week split, as we all seem to be calling the bro split now, to eventually, you know, I went to then training chest twice a week. That made sense. So I did the same amount of volume, but split over two times. So then it was chest one day and then chest and shoulders the next day. It would have been just shoulders on its own. Now it's chest and shoulders. Eventually, and I kept the same amount of volume per week. Eventually, I did go to push-pull legs. And when I did, I initially trained 6 days a week, Scott. And I kept the same amount of volume per week.
Mm-hmm.
What I found was I just listened to my body. And I started finding that I needed to do less sets. is what it first came down to. So there was an evolution. Mm-hmm. At first I was doing like, we'll say 16 sets, 8 sets each time I worked out for each body part. So it'd be, you know, 8 sets for chest, 8 sets for shoulders, 8 sets for triceps. Then later in the week, I'd do the same thing again. Over time, I started seeing I wasn't recovering. And so I started doing, and I started seeing I could get more out of less than I didn't need 8 sets is what it came down mm-hmm. to. So I started decreasing that. And then it got down to the point where I was like, okay, that was a really good workout and I'm doing a lot less sets than I used to. But because I wanted to be progressive with it, I started finding, well, shit, I'm supposed to train chest again today. I'm not going to be able to do what I need to do to be my best. So then I started doing, and then I realized that's when it hit me. And I realized, well, 6 days isn't going to work for me. I guess I'll take an extra day off this week. I guess I'll do 5 days a week. And mm-hmm. over time that became, well, I guess I'm going to do 4 days a week. And that's where I settled in at. So there wasn't I don't know if you could have given me that formula out the gate, but mm-hmm. through experience, I just took what I was already doing and I said, well, okay, logically, once again, I'll split that in half and do it all twice, you know, within mm-hmm. a push-pull legs routine. Then from there, I started dwindling down on the sets because I didn't need them. And then from there, I started taking more rest days because that's what it required in order for me to perform at my best when I came back to a given workout. So 4 days a week mm-hmm. is good for me. But like I said, man, it's something I couldn't tell him what he needs to do because he's obviously not me, you know, just like you couldn't have told me what I needed to do. Right.
Yeah. You settled into that. And it was based on what made sense for each workout, which you could handle.
Yeah.
And so you had all those parameters. Also the thing that you didn't mention too, is that some people like, maybe they don't want to train on the weekends and maybe that's what they want to do on the weekends.
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, if you've got a situation where you've got a 3-way split and you're training 4 times a week, then that's going to mean that you're going to have different amount of days rest between the workouts.
Yeah.
So you might go, let's say you don't want to train on the weekends. So that might be the case. So you do legs, push, off, pull, legs, off, push, pull. So sometimes you're going to have a pull and a legs right after one another.
Yeah.
And that's not going to bode well. On those days, you're not going to be able to do, you know, deads and then squats the next day.
Right, right.
So you're going to have to come up with a way to different workouts for different scenarios. And it may just be that you've got, you know, I usually rotating amongst 3 different exercise or 3 sets of exercises works well. Mm. You don't have like an acute sort of learning effect that contributes largely to your gains. It seems the gains are more reflective of actual muscle mass. As long as you're doing exercises you've been doing for years.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you just squatted every week, then you're going to get better at squats because you're getting better at squats, not because you're necessarily getting more muscle that's allowing you to do squats with heavier loads or more for more reps. So you're going to have to come up with some, if like, let's say you're on your leg days, you're going to do barbell back squats, some sort of a standing squat, 2 different standing squat type of variations. So 3 squatting variations.
Yeah.
You're going to run into a day sometimes, depending on the week, because of how the workouts get sequenced, because you're training 4 times a week, but it's a 3-way split, where you're going to have done back, and then legs are going to be the next day, and it's going to be potentially low back intensive leg back workout, and then mm-hmm. some sort of a, unless you have alternative exercises that for those particular days,
which that would make sense, so, yeah,
like a leg press or some sort of leg press variation instead of some sort of squat variation. So, like literally, and the reason I went through all that rigmarole is to show you that. Like if you're not training on the weekends, if you have certain days of the week you're going to adhere to, that in and of itself can dictate the nature of the program you set up to a very large degree, because you just can't get away with that. You'll end up burying yourself or getting hurt.
Yeah.
And once you kind of get behind on the low back, that's like one of the main things I think that really gets people who are trying to train heavy is like once you start, you know, setting your low back starts to sort of being chronically sore.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hard thing to get out of. Like you're going to have to like really step back for a couple weeks on mm-hmm. the exercises that cause that.
Yeah. I know that firsthand. There's no question.
I do too. Yeah. So, That's why so many people, I think they do that for years and they still can't squat. They can't squat anymore because they beat themselves to shit, you know?
Yeah.
I can still squat because I've tried to pay attention to that. My low back still gets hit by it, but I still squat and do rack deads because I don't ever let that happen. I just know better.
That makes sense.
That's a good question.
We're about like an hour plus in here, so I think this would be a good time to stop. I know we talked about pulling. We always have extra stuff. We always I think we're always what's the word I'm looking for here, Scott? We always overplan. We have a lot of extra.
We're like Boy Scouts. We come prepared.
Yes. Yes. I know you're doing some stuff over there at John Meadows site. You know, we all know John had gotten ill, had a heart attack, and he's recovering from that. And I know you've jumped in. Fuad has jumped in, and I think some others have jumped in to help create content over there for the Mountain Dog website while he's down. That's pretty cool, man. How's that going?
It's good. I got I gathered a people. This will probably be out and on the site, I think, before this comes out. So
okay.
I decided to gather a baker's dozen in honor of John's love of donuts. So I got 13 questions.
Nice.
And they're all over the place. We kind of read through them. They're like everything from, you know, do you need full range of motion to hormonal related stuff?
Yeah.
You know, for both men and women. So it took me a couple of days to put them together. Cause it, like, yeah, I love like when you cover those sorts of questions that are like, people just ask sort of wide open questions, you know, like what's the best this? Like one of the questions is something like what's the best diet and non-conventional supplements for lipid profile and LDL?
Hmm.
Well, the best diet, like that's just gigantic. There's so much literature. There's so many meta-analyses and reviews and different ways of looking at that. Like that's, but yeah, I have to, and I've dug into that. It's in my Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach book. So I've, you know, gone through that, but I still like to go back and see what else has come out in the last year and piece all that together. So I always have to over, and maybe I spend 5 minutes answering the question, but I spend an hour and 50 minutes digging into stuff because you want to, you know, make sure that, you know, you're not just skimming through the surface because there's some really important, as we talked about today, like there's some really important subtle nuances to the information that can be the most important thing. And I'm going to leave people with this because you and I maybe talked about this. So something that there's a book called The Black Swan. I forget the name of the author right now, but basically there's a whole series of these books. And this is something that has sort of guided the way I look at research for years now. And the idea of a black swan is something that's an extraordinary statistical outlier. It's that completely almost unpredictable occurrence that happens that in various aspects of our lives. So like the 9/11 disaster was one that was no one expected. It just completely came out of nowhere. Had someone been able to predict that, it wouldn't have happened. We would have prevented it.
Yeah.
People talk about like for this pandemic, the black swan of the pandemic wasn't necessarily the virus. People would have guessed, you know, that there's, you know, all the various things that people are suspecting may have gone into the fact that this virus has been out and doing what it's doing. Be they conspiracy theories or not, the black swan, the unusual thing, there's an article that I can't remember was written on this idea. It was the fact that how we decided to do the lockdown.
Hmm.
You ask someone 15, 20 years ago, would we have ever locked down in this way? Can you imagine Americans putting up with this?
No.
You know?
No.
People, so that was really...
Hey, if you asked me 2 months ago, 3 months ago, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. So that's a really unusual... That's a black swan.
Huh.
It's like this unusual, like almost unpredictable type of occurrence. And those things happen in research all the time. You have these studies or these outlier individuals who a lot of times, like literally in statistics, if you make note of it and don't, you know, try to cover it up and say like, you know, we employed, you know, so-and-so's strategy for removing outliers from our data.
Mm-hmm.
They just take those high and low non-responders or high responders or whatever it may be, and they just throw those people out. They just throw those, like, those are aberrant data points.
Yeah.
Just throw them out. Because we look at the means and the averages. But it's the extraordinary circumstances that oftentimes change history.
Hmm.
9/11, this pandemic, I think, is going to be it's a historical event, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And if you're looking for ways in terms of, like, for instance, to produce more muscle growth, from narrow us down to a bodybuilding perspective again, it's those individuals who are grow really, really well, who are put on size really, really rapidly, or those studies which show a significant effect, even if they're a minority, that tell us that something happened there, something's possible. This can be had because we've documented that it does. Let's not do, and this is what meta-analyses don't do this necessarily. They're looking at the means, looking at the averages, and saying like, well, you know, on average, we can't expect, based on the sum of the literature so far, that doing this is going to create this increase in muscle growth. Like, mm-hmm. we're not going to find that. But there are studies that show that it can, and it does happen.
Yeah.
So why is that? Is it poor measurement? Was it the fact that maybe their subjects were highly motivated? You know, why did this happen? That's where the really cool shit lies.
Yeah.
So we usually, sometimes we just throw that out. So, like, this is an odd, like, this study that we talked about today with the no load train, that's a weird friggin' thing, you know?
Yeah.
That's why I brought it up. No one would think about doing that. But then we tied it together to, like, well, this is what underlies this mind-muscle connection that bodybuilders have known is important for decades upon decades. Mm. The squeeze and all those other things, like that study is points to this idea, which we know just from in the trenches bodybuilding can be an important one for producing muscle growth. And you found it with your back,
yeah.
You know, training with Shelby. So those sorts of things are important. So when looking at literature, if you see, like, you know, only one out of 20 studies showed this, don't just throw it out. For me, I'm like, I want to know why it worked. If that's what we're looking for in terms of practical application, I'm gonna say, well, this was an outlier. But why was it an outlier?
Yeah.
That's where the cool shit is. Yeah. You know, I want to be an outlier. Bodybuilders want to be outliers. That's the whole point. We are outliers. You want people to say, like, I think I've heard Ken say this, and I've heard some people say, like, someone immediately, you know, if you are a real, if you're a bodybuilder, have been for years, and people don't accuse you of having used gear, whether you have or haven't, then maybe something's wrong. People should be accusing you because you're such an outlier. You look so extraordinary.
Yeah.
You want to look like a freak. So, like, look to the freaky studies if you want to learn how to be a freak. There might be, not necessarily every time, but there might be something there. So that's my sort of thought to leave people with, is look for those odd, unusual occurrences that demonstrate the possibilities that we're seeking as bodybuilders, and see if there's something to be gleaned for that information, rather than just saying, "Ah, Ronnie Coleman didn't do it, you know, so it can't work," or whatever the things people typically say when they just sort of, you know, toss information to the side because it doesn't fit with the averages.
Yeah.
We don't want to be average. There's a lot to be had from looking at means and using inferential statistics, et cetera. But there's also a lot to be had from looking at those outlier black swan type of occurrences too. So that's the nugget I'll leave people with.
All right. Well, in that case, for another episode of Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson, I'm Scott McNally. Guys, if you haven't gone over to the YouTube page, if you're watching this on Facebook, head on over. You can subscribe over there. If you're listening to this on iTunes, do us a favor. Hit a review for us. Give us a good 5-star review. That'll help more people find us over on iTunes. And thanks for watching, guys. For another episode of Muscle Minds, Dr. Scott Stevenson, I'm Scott McNally. We'll see you soon. Thanks, Scott.
Peace. You got it.